The lights are on red. We're away.
Hello and welcome to MotoGPOD, the internet radio show about motorcycle road racing. Today is Friday, January 18th, 2008. This is episode number 111, and I am Bob Hayes, your host, here today to talk about motorcycles and all sorts of good stuff. As you may have noticed, the last several shows we've had quite a bit going on about track days and kind of diverging away from our focus of motorcycle racing, professional motorcycle road racing, and sort of talking about doing it yourself. So we're going to not talk too much about track days on this show. This one is going to be more about motorcycles. We've got a call with Liam Schubert, our man in Spain, working for the Dantin Ducati race team. So that's a real good one. We've got that coming up. And before that, we've got a few things to touch on. The very first thing I want to mention is a big thank you shout out to Chris Spindler and Tony Pagliaroli, or Tony Pags, a.k.a. Tony Pags, a very worthy Sopranos-sounding sort of nickname, and Brian Worthing. Thanks to all those guys very much. They made donations at the MotoGPOD website, sending a little bit of money for the cause, help pay the hosting bills and the Skype bills and all that sort of thing, and I really appreciate it, guys. Thanks very much. It's the money will go to a good cause one way or the other, either paying for the hosting and all of that sort of thing, or maybe paying the beer tab. I don't know, one of the two, but I do appreciate it again. Thanks a lot. And let's see other stuff we got going on. The last few shows, like I said, we've done a lot about track days, and things have been a little disjointed. I haven't had a lot of time to do the usual meticulous research that you've been accustomed to on MotoGPOD, but it's just been a very, very busy time for me with the holidays and all that sort of thing, and it's looking like that it's going to continue through the rest of January. My son is going in the Marine Corps. He leaves in just a little over a week, so he's going to be going off to boot camp to get a serious dose of attitude adjustment and hopefully focus training that will do him a lot of good. And I got to say, I'm very, very proud of him for making that decision. He's going to be enlisting in the Marines. He's going to be a linguist. So I think that's kind of cool stuff. So a big shout out to my son. And I would have joined the Marines. As you may know, I'm in the Navy. I'm in the Navy Reserves. I'm a CB in the Navy, and we help the Marines a lot in the CBs. I possibly might have considered joining the Marines, but my ASVAB scores were way too high. So I joined the Navy instead. And anybody who's familiar with the military will get that little jab. All right, moving on. Let's see, what do we got going on in the world of motorcycle racing? Like I said, things have been a very, very busy time. I haven't been able to keep up as tightly as I'd like to on the news, but on the other hand, there hasn't been a whole lot of really worthy sort of news going on. So I'm going to read a few emails, do a couple other things, that sort of stuff here in the intro, and then we're going to get into our call with Liam. First thing I want to touch on, and this is a news item, and this showed up on Crash.net and several other places and all that sort of thing, and the quick Crash.net version is, Doohan opens Vegas nightclub. Star-studded lineup attended to the opening of new $11 million Las Vegas nightclub, co-owned by former five-time 500cc world champion Mick Doohan. And Doohan, blah, 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 at the launch of the Cat House, which is in the Luxor, and I picked up their actual press release from the Luxor in Las Vegas, talking about that thing. And unfortunately, it doesn't sound like this nightclub focuses much on motorcycles. It's more on the sort of, it's a discreet playpen for spontaneous, provocative, and sophisticated entertainment, a loungerie inspired by the rich opulence of a 19th century European bordello. So it pretty much sounds like my kind of place. They're talking about the intro partner, Mick Doohan, five-time world MotoGP motorcycle racing champion and a 20-year resident of Monaco, will infuse the venue with his jet-set lifestyle. So I think that's kind of cool. Mick Doohan's sort of bringing a touch of motorcycle class to the Cat House at the Luxor. And as you know, I do go to Vegas every year for a trade show, so I'll probably be stopping by. Sounds like it's a little bit rich for my normal blood. I'm kind of a cheap, low-rent sort of a guy most of the time, but I'll figure out a way to get down there one way or the other. All right, moving on to some more serious stuff, because that was somewhat silly. I got several emails this week. Got a lot of emails this week. Thanks a lot, guys. I do appreciate it. If you want to send an email, the address is always bob@motogpod.com. And I always like getting emails. It's always nice to try to answer them all. One of the things I got here was from Kevin, who's sent me several emails in the past. It's Kev Daniels. And he was talking about my comments from the Dakar Rally where I mentioned that it had been canceled from last week, where they canceled the Dakar rally because of threats from Al-Qaeda. And this made that they felt that the rally organizers felt that there was too much of a threat going on and that they would rather cancel the show rather than risk the chance of a fan or crew member or racer or anybody being injured or taken hostage or just whatever. And, you know, so I made some comments in the last show. You kind of have to listen to that show if you haven't heard it to hear those comments. But basically, it was somewhat in a joking theme, but it pisses me off. So Kev says that he, you know, found on a forum some comments about the Dakar below that were basically a guy saying the same thing that I had said, that we let those terrorist bastards win. And but Kev's point is that there's so much at risk that there's really nothing else to do. He says there's more than one way to wreck a rally, and these people are creative, these people being the terrorists, and so we have to use the term people very, very loosely. But he's right, you know, because one of the things I suggested jokingly, is this was an entirely of a joke, was escort the race with, you know, Humvees, armored gun trucks, and helicopters flying overhead and all this sort of thing. And I had this mental vision that apparently I didn't make quite clear of, you know, this big cluster of those big trucks and the various different types of cars they have and the motorcycles all just gang together, trudging along slowly at about 15 or 20 miles an hour with these Humvee gun trucks. And so he's right. You know, that might not have been 100% appropriate. Maybe I didn't get my point across, but basically my point was that it makes me mad, but I do see the necessity of it, and there's really no other way around it. So thanks a lot, Kev, for that email. Then we're going to touch on track bikes a little bit. I just can't resist. This one was actually from Tony Pags before he sent me an email talking about track bikes. And I had mentioned again in the last show the 400cc class of racing motorcycles that they tend to race a lot in Japan and all that sort of thing, and they're quite rare in the United States. And Tony says, about the only 400cc sport bike that was imported into the U.S. was the FZR 400, which dominated the lightweight classes until the SV650 reared its ugly head. And 400 is a spectacular ride with an aluminum frame and swing arm that was way ahead of its time. It's much more expensive in 1990 than its larger sibling, the FZR 600, which is ultimately why they do not import the 400s anymore. And Tony went on to say in a couple other emails that while these are available, because I checked on eBay, and hey, sure enough, look, 1989 FZR 400, and it was like, you know, $1,100, I mean, pretty cheap. This is something for the very, very serious a hobbyist, and you really, it's got to be sort of a work of, you know, a thing of passion and all that to want to get one of these, because you're going to find it difficult to get parts and there's a lot of maintenance involved and everything. You're talking a very old motorcycle of which limited numbers were imported and so on and so forth. So while it'd be interesting sort of concept, it might not be something that the casual track day guy like myself is going to want to take on. You know, this has to be something where this is your main primary focus. All right, let's see. Moving on. Next email that we got going on. This one's from Nick Simpson in the UK, and the subject is Barry Sheen. He says, "Hi, Bob. I have just spent the best hour watching television that I have had in many years. I'm a lucky British listener with access to the Biography Channel in the UK, and I have now seen the Sheen documentary. He says, lots of old family photos and movies that even I had never seen before as a fan of over 20 years. He says, I hope that in time you're able to see it in the United States." And I hope so too. I checked their website. Absolutely no mention whatsoever of the show. They do have a little mini bio of Barry Sheen, but they're not talking about show. You know, it's on the website written out in text. It's not talking about having the show broadcast. I sent them a little email on their suggesting thing saying, hey, please, can we show this in the United States? Because I would watch it. And I suggest you guys do too. Go to biography.com. At the bottom of the page, there's a contact us link. And then you sort of choose, you know, programming, general questions, or something like that. Just type out a thing. Hey, we want the Barry Sheen documentary. If enough people do it, they will show it. Or better yet, if you got the time and write out a real letter. A real letter carries a lot more weight than an email or a phone call or anything like that. An actual real live letter. These guys figure that if anybody writes a real letter, that's what like 1,000 people think. So whatever. Let's tell the Biography Channel that we want the damn Barry Sheen documentary. And while we're talking about TV, I got to go back real quick to the Dakar rally comment, because one of the things that kind of torqued me off about the whole thing, and this is a little bit selfish, is that I readjusted my whole satellite package and everything, and I was making sure I got the Versus channel so that I could watch the Dakar rally this year, and then they canceled it, and I was like, ah, very disappointed. But I found that there's quite a lot of channels in this sort of upper tier of satellite dish network stuff that I'm enjoying. And one of them, I'm ashamed to say, is the Fox Reality Channel. And this is nothing but 24 hours a day of reality crap. But I'll tell you, there's a lot of diamonds in the rough in there. And one of them that I was watching the other day was The Long Way Round. And I haven't seen The Long Way Round since it first came out. And I watched it on, I think it was on Bravo here in the United States. But, which, gosh, is Bravo even still around? Whatever it was, The Long Way Round. And I watched most of the episode where they were in Mongolia, and you're seeing Ewan McGregor and Charlie Borman going across Mongolia on these just absolute non-roads and eating the sheep's testicles and all of that. And it was just, it was such a great show, and I enjoyed it so much, and it reminded me how much I had enjoyed that series. So if you have not seen The Long Way Round, I encourage you to find that one on DVD or tune into the charming Fox Reality Channel or whatever to make sure you watch it as you see Ewan McGregor and Charlie Borman going around the world, or actually, excuse me, the Long Way Round part is from England to New York, but going the long way around, going riding motorcycles all the way across Asia, then in Alaska, and then across North America and all of that sort of thing. It's a great, great, great show. And then they made another one called The Long Way Down, where they go from north to south. And I haven't seen that one yet either. So I'm going to go and make a point of getting that on the DVD and watch that one. And there we go. That's enough about The Long Way Around. All right, next thing that we're going to talk about, let's talk a little bit more about Laguna Seca. We know that in the United States, Laguna Seca, even though we have two MotoGP races this year, which is awesome, Laguna Seca does come up first. It's coming up in July. Tickets have been on sale for quite a while now, since November. So if you haven't bought your tickets, it's time to seriously think about going to their website at lagunaseca.com or laguna-seca.com, excuse me, and buying your tickets. And one of the things here is that I got an email. It's from Rich Angermiller, and he's got some additions to my Laguna Seca travel notes that we put out a while ago. Some of the suggestions that I have found about a couple trips to Laguna Seca and things you might want to think about, and we expanded on this over the last few shows and all of that sort of thing. And so Rich wanted to add a few things. He says, most of these are related to those who are staying in town. So this is an excellent sort of adjunct to my stuff, which was talking about camping. So here what Rich says. First of all, bring earplugs. I can't agree more with earplugs. It should be mandatory for those of you who have been to an AMA race or, you know, even a World Superbike race. He says, there's absolutely no comparison to the sound level of a GP bike. Another word of warning is being in the vendor area during practice time. Make sure you know when that practice starts, because some of those tents are right up against the track. I got caught twice in a vendor area with a bike ripping by, and damn, that hurt. And he's right. The earplugs are a must. Vendor area. This is one of the highlights of the event. Pretty much every serious racing vendor is there, and it's unheard of on the East Coast, even at the Cycle World shows. As a track day rider, I really appreciated seeing stuff in person that I can only witness online normally from day to day. And he's right. That's also fun. Just got to make sure that your time going in the vendor area doesn't interfere with your enjoyment of the MotoGP on-track action. Then Rich says, water, and this is all in caps, bring, borrow, and steal as much as you can. And yes, he's right. Having been there in the 2006 heat wave, water was worth more than gasoline. Camelbacks loaded with ice are worth their weight in gold because the prices of water are criminal. He says, even if it's not hot, there is zero shade, and it's rather dry at Laguna. Very easy to dehydrate, and you cannot rely on grabbing a bottle of water when you need it because of the long lines. On the same note, save the beer for the end of the day. It just adds in dehydration. And, yeah, Rich, that's where you digress a little bit. But I don't drink a lot of beer. He's right. He's right. You know, you limit yourself to, you know, be sensible. You know, if you have a beer, have a glass of water. How about that? And I always bring my own water. I hate paying for water. It drives me nuts to pay for water. And you see people, you know, they routinely buy a bottle of water for $1.50. And it's like a pint of water or whatever the hell it is. It costs a lot more than gasoline. So I will, yes, usually buy like a case of the cheap bottled water, and I'll bring that along, and I'll just carry several of those in my pockets when I go to the race. And who wear cargo shorts or whatever like that, and I'm bulging with water, or a camelback is another good solution and all that sort of thing. So if you're, again, back to the camping versus hotel sort of thing, down in the campsite areas, water supplies are pretty much non-existent. So you got to bring your own water, bring several gallon jugs, whatever, that sort of thing. So you can fill up a camelback, you can fill up those little small water bottles, or George, just bring the cases of water bottles, whatever you're going to do. But you do want to make sure that you drink lots of water. Don't drink the Gatorade. That's not what you need. You need water. All right. Back to Rich's email while we digress on our water lecture. Okay, Monterey Bus Service. He says, finally, they got this in order. The system works great, and it's far better than trying to drive in. They get better routes, so it's quicker to get back to Monterey than driving, and the buses were packed with fans, so it's quite fun. There's about a dozen or so pickup points in Monterey and Salinas, so it's very, very convenient. And that's a good point, something I totally overlooked because, like I said, I'm a camper guy, and I'll either walk up that hill or take the little bus that goes up the hill. And then he says, do not leave the event right after the last race. Even if you're taking the bus, the crowd is pretty large and the lines get very long and you're standing in the sun. Driving out is just a no-go as expected. There's still a lot going on in the vendor area and the pits and a lot less people, so just hang out till 6:30 or so. Downtown parties do not start till 8 p.m. or later. And that's another excellent point. Get there early. The best time I had was arriving at 7:30 on Saturday. Very few people, and I got to watch early practice right at the bridge on the corkscrew, which is almost impossible during the qualifying or race sessions. The vendor area gets very crowded, so if you want some time with a sales rep, those mornings are best, and he's right on this. If you want a little one-on-one interaction with a guy, there will be people there with helmets and everything, and they'll give you fittings and all sorts of good stuff, but you do have to get a chance to talk to this guy, and Friday or early mornings are going to be your best bet. He says the pit area is also way less crowded, and your chances of a picture with Rossi is much higher. Once the crowds come in, the racers tend to hide, and I do not blame them. Rich says, now, sunscreen. I think you touched on this, but I can't stress enough. I saw way too many red people walking around, many to the point of serious skin damage. There is zero shade at the place, so even if it's not hot, people will get seriously burnt. And this is true, that California sun can sneak up on you. In Monterey, the weather is comparatively mild. It doesn't usually, I mean, 2006 was a big exception. It doesn't usually get, though, unpleasantly hot. But even so, it is sunny, and that sun will cook you. Bring in food, especially snacks. Like most events, food is very overpriced. Some of it was quite good, but the lines were always long, and it's just not worth the hassle. Yes, this is another good point. So, you know, you got to pick your how you want your event to go. If you want your event to go with, you know, a catered lunch and all that sort of thing, consider one of the suites. I've gotten several emails talking about the flag suites and all these sorts of things. And if those tickets are still available, they're a great value. There's also the USMotoGPFans.com, Laguna Seca, Nikki Hayden Fan Club suites that are available. All these are great, where they put out a great spread of food and free booze and all that sort of stuff. If you just go on the grandstand seat ticket, you might be, you know, run down and buy a burger or a roast beef sandwich or something like that. And those are not too bad as well. But yeah, they are overpriced. And if you're looking at sort of trying to save your money so that you can go out in the town of Monterey that evening or whatever, yeah, bring in some snacks, you know, put a sandwich in a bag. Plan your location. To get into the vendor area, you need to cross the dreaded tire bridge. This is the Dunlop Bridge. If this is near the start of a race or during lunchtime, you're going to have a horrible experience. It's not that wide, and you'll be slammed up against tons of stinky, sweaty people, and it's hotter than hell. I think there might be another minor bridge somewhere, but it's not in such a convenient a place. I'm trying to think. There's the other bridge over by the Turn 4 grandstands, and yeah, it's definitely not in as convenient of a place. Then he says, let's see, cruise the motorcycle parking areas. The amount of rare bikes in California are amazing, and most of which show up for that race. Just from crossing the lots to get to my seat, I've seen a Ducati Senna, Honda RFV 750, a Yamaha 500 two-stroke, Honda NSR 400, well, and other unheard-of rare bikes. It's like an amazing free bike show and well worth the effort to cruise those motorcycle parking areas. And get to Monterey on Saturday night. Even if you're not into parties, the Cannery Row area is amazing. The bikes alone are well worth it. I've never seen so many rare two-strokes in my life. Thousands of race fans and minor events all packed within a four-block area. Even walked right past Ben Bostrom on a dark side street on my way there. Wow. And you're, who knows, maybe you're lucky to have kept your wallet on that one, Rich. I don't know. And then he says, get to the Portola Hotel in downtown Monterey and see the bike show / auction. If you love rare race bikes, this is the place to be. It's totally free and it's well worth it. well worth that. It would be well worth more than that, I'm sure, is what you meant to say on that one, Rich. The lobby of the hotel was packed with rare XGP bikes and tons of rare street bikes that are only seen in magazines. Highlights are Caparossi's 05 Ducati GP bike up for auction. Wow, and right there in the lobby. Other rare bikes on display were Bimota's, classic Ducati's, GP bikes from the 80s, and even the Bat bike from the old Batman TV series. All displayed inside like true museum pieces. And did I mention this was all for free? And he's right. This is a cool thing to do for free. This is fun stuff. And you may also want to know, one of the things I remembered, and I've forgotten it was in this email, he says, you may also want to note that there are other suite options besides the pit lane boxes. There's four other covered suite areas that have pretty much the same view, same benefits, with slightly less of a view. He's like, I was lucky enough to grab a turn four suite ticket in 06, and it was well worth the $500 price tag. The food was excellent, all you can eat and all you can drink, yes, free premium beer, which this kind of belies your earlier statement, Rich, of laying off the beer, but that's fine. We'll A-slide on that one because it's talking about beer. Private air-conditioned bathrooms, TV monitors, and shade from the sun. On the downside, these seats sell out in like 2 hours after going on sale, but they're well worth it if you see someone trying to sell one. Considering that admission tickets, a pit pass, grandstand seats, and parking will run you over $250, the grandstands are actually a pretty good deal. And he's right, they are. They're an excellent deal if you can get into those suites, the flag suites and all that sort of thing there. Just go to laguna-seca.com. They've got it all laid out, and hopefully a lot of it's still available. It says, overall, Laguna is like no other. Even though Indy is much closer to me, the character and personality of the track at Laguna and the area is much more unique, in my humble opinion. Now, if only they could bring the 125s and 250s to Laguna. And again, on that one, Rich, I'm with you all the way, brother. I really wish we'd bring the support classes out there. I mean, I love the AMA. I like seeing that stuff. But I don't know. I'd like to have a pure MotoGP weekend. Nothing but MotoGP. Bring the 125s. Bring the 250s. Bring the big boys. And if you got to have another support class, which is good. I like support classes. You know, bring out the Red Bull Cup or the BMWs or whoever you are running that year as the support classes. So, all right, there's some Laguna Seca travel notes. Kind of blathered on quite a long introduction right now, but that's okay. So we've got Liam's call coming up now. So why don't we go ahead and get on with that, and let's start talking to Liam. All right, we got Liam Schubert, our man in Spain, working for the Dantin Ducati team. How you doing, Liam?
I'm doing great. Hey, Bob, and hey, everyone out there in MotoGPOD land.
It's cool. It's good to have you on the show. We haven't talked to you in a long time, Liam. It's been a busy holiday season for both of us and stuff. Did you have a good one, by the way?
I had a fantastic holiday season, maybe the best one I've had in years, which is not to discount the fun that I had in previous ones, but this one was really memorable for a bunch of reasons.
That's awesome. That's good stuff. So, but now all that is behind us, and it's time to start thinking about the next MotoGP season. So our winter test ban is over, and you guys are heading off to Malaysia next week, right?
Right. I'll be leaving Barcelona on Saturday morning. It's a full day of travel to get out there. So we arrive Saturday night, and then we've got Sunday to adjust to the time difference. We usually have a day when we do those long-haul missions to kind of relax and walk around the city and do whatever we want. And then starting Monday, we'll be at the track setting up for the first time in 2008.
Cool deal. And now you guys, what bikes are you running? Are you running the 08s or are you going to run the 07s? Or?
We'll be running the GP8.
Cool.
Quite excited about that. I mean, I saw all the pieces and the evolution of the bike, and It's a really good step. I hope we stay in front of the Japanese bikes.
Well, yeah, that article came out where Ducati's thinking that Honda's the biggest threat and this and that. You know, a little bit of, you never know if it's press talk or if it's legitimate. Trepidation, exactly. But
I have to say, if you look at the results, starting from Brno, or maybe the race after Brno, the factory Hondas were quite strong. It was evident when Pedrosa blew past Stoner on the straightaway that they had a motor that was working for them. That just needed to work out their reliability kinks, but it's looking like that was definitely the strongest bike by the end of the season as far as engine. And who knows, you know, what they've done with their electronics, if they've taken a big step forward in that, because it's increasingly apparent, even though we might have pointed this out in years past, that the higher the level of technology goes and sophistication of the bikes, the more everyone is within the same time frame. You know, just split seconds are separating everybody, and what's making up the biggest difference is electronics. Right. If everybody's got a competent bike and about the same horsepower and the same tires, then it comes down to electronics in a lot of cases. So we'll see. I mean, finally, it's going to get started. You know, I've been waiting for this since the first week of November, when the last race in Valencia was. And, boy, it didn't really stop at Valencia. I kind of thought, okay, last race can take a little bit of a breather. But things got really dizzy really fast. And, you know, before I knew it, we had our first test of the season the week after in Valencia with everybody else, where we had some shakedown runs with our new riders because we were fielding two new riders for us this year. Then after that, I had to go to Italy, Bologna, for a one-week inventory process where we check in the 2007 parts and return 2007 material and plan what, you know, some of the material that we're going to take in 2008. And then I had a week off almost to kind of finish up the documents and paperwork from the inventory. I had my birthday that week. I didn't really do very much. And then immediately after that, I had to go back to the factory for a week because we received our 2008 material to build the GP8s. So I met up with the skeleton crews. I call them the skeleton crew because it's not the full team, but just the top three mechanics from each side and the data and electronics acquisition people. And we learned about the GP8, what's different, what has evolved, what some of the new systems are going to do. And then we built our bikes. And then after that, I spent a week in Madrid kind of preparing more documents and lists for the material we'd need for 2008, just kind of to clean up the race shop, because when Christmas came, I didn't think anybody was going to be there for about 2 weeks, so it was nice to kind of end the year and wrap that up. Then I went back to California. I had an amazing Christmas with my girlfriend and my good friends, and just a really tight core of people around me. I wanted to keep it really quiet this particular winter. And then I got back, and now it's time to leave.
Wow. So, yeah, so you got a couple of weeks back in the States and everything. I guess, it's something, right? And
absolutely. Yeah. Maybe the best 3 weeks I've had since I've moved out to Europe.
Really?
Back in California. I mean, it's less of an adventure when you go back home. I know where the restaurants are. I know what the traffic patterns are going to be like. You know, it's not new for me, but at the same time, it's finally being able to relax a little bit and know that I'm never going to have to worry about getting lost, because I know exactly where I'm going, and I know I can speak with anybody and get directions. I'm not driving on the wrong side of the road. I'm not worried about my flights. You definitely feel a different measure of relaxation when you get back home.
Yeah, sure.
And
sure.
That's something, you know, that from being away from home for so long when you were deployed, it just, after a while, it builds up. And I don't think that I expected it to build up quite so much by the end of last season. All the pressure from work and a lot of the changes that the team was undergoing. In a way, we lost certain people that, you know, switched teams at the end of the season. And some of their workload was taken on by myself and a few of the other guys. So that was kind of a reshuffle that, even though we technically have the same job title as last year, you know, there's a few other responsibilities. And it's good because it forces you to grow yet again. Maybe I wasn't quite as prepared as I thought to take that other step, but everything's changing. And, in MotoGP, it's fluid. And, you know, I said from day one, you just have to be able to adapt. And it's the same for the riders, and it's the same for us. It's always changing.
Sure, sure, definitely. So do you feel that Barcelona, do you kind of count Barcelona as close to home at all now? Or, I mean, are you...
I do, because yeah. I've got a good situation with my roommates. I've been with them for a year now. You know, I wanted to make a big change in 2007, so I purposely moved apartments at the beginning of the year, January 1st. because I thought, oh, okay, it's a new year. I want to be in a new place and just kind of have a good space around me. So I changed apartments to a smaller place, but, you know, I live with these two girls from the island of Mallorca off of Spain, and they're both students, so they've got their own thing going on, and they don't bother me too much, and generally the house stays fairly clean. But, yeah, it's been good with them the last year, so I decided, okay, I've got a good place here. I really like the area that I live in. I know the city of Barcelona. So, it's definitely home base. I don't have any of the types of relationships here that I have back in California, which is what made this Christmas break so special, the ability to just turn my computer off and say at the beginning of the day, okay, I'm going to go get this to eat, and then I want to get some more of this to eat, and then I'm going to go over to my buddy Jay's house, and we're going to mess around with engines and not really care at all about, oh, I need to be somewhere at 5 o'clock, or I need to be somewhere at 6, or I've got an appointment later. It seems like when I'm in Barcelona, because I'm either here for 1 or 2 weeks at a time, every day just kind of rips on by and bleeds into the next, and I kind of lose time when I'm out in Europe or whether I'm traveling. You know, I wasn't even sure exactly what day it was. I knew the date, but I didn't know what day it was in the week. But in California, it was great because I didn't log on to Skype for 3 weeks. I mean, that's the longest I've ever gone without logging on to that. And except for work emails, I'd check my work email every day and spend a little bit of time on that if there were work emails that came through. But luckily, everybody shut down for about 2 weeks over the holidays. And most of the emails that I got were either personal or emails from other team members saying, hey, I just remembered this. Could you check on this for me? And that's one of the things where when you've got a small team like ours, everybody kind of has a lot to do. And, you know, if somebody says, hey, I just remember this, then you got to remember it too, and you got to get on it, because sometimes, you know, deadlines get pushed back and you're right on the wire and you're like, man, we got to get this right now. Otherwise, it's not going to be there in January. So we had to take care of some of that. And then further, I guess there was another strike in Italy. I'm not sure, but the shipping company that hauls all the boxes around the world contacted us and said, hey, we want to pick up the material for Sepang earlier. So whereas it would have shipped out at the beginning of this week and had a week to travel to Malaysia, we had to ship it out early, which meant the factory had to get all our stuff ready a little bit earlier than they anticipated, and it just kind of spiraled. But suffice it to say, the material, all our flight boxes are going to Malaysia, and we're going to be ready to rock when everybody else is.
That's good. So the strike is not going to disrupt any of the testing or anything like that.
No. I mean, not like a major strike. I'm not even sure exactly what it was. The fact that none of my Italians called me and said, oh, man, this is horrible. That's a good thing. But I do know that there was a day where there was a gas shortage. So people weren't driving to work because there was no gas at the petrol stations. You know, and things, odd things of that nature were, you know, it's difficult to grasp from an American's perspective because that really doesn't happen. Or if there is a strike that happens, it's a major, major deal. And people are prepared to go on strike for months. You know, they put money in their strike fund and you expect to see them for 6 months picketing. But it's a little bit more common, I guess, in Italy just as a way to flex. You know, between two parties, one party can flex and say, oh, we're going on strike this afternoon. We're taking off 3 hours.
For our strike.
Like, well, what is that?
Yeah.
But that's, you know, it's part of the difference in cultures. And I'm just happy to be out here and be a part of this.
Oh, sure.
Great article on soup, incidentally. I just want to point this out. Great interview with Mark Elder on Superbike Planet a few weeks ago that I caught while I was back in the States. And, you know, I've spoken to Mark since then. But it was a really nice write-up. I'm surprised it came from Dean. Just kidding.
Oh, come on.
No, it was a really good write-up for Mark. And I was happy to read about it. He's had a, you know, a similar kind of similar road as me, except his is basically all Italian, whereas my road is a little bit more Spanish. And it was just fun reading about Mark, because we both studied at MMI together, which is the Motorcycle Mechanics Institute, and we both used to work on Harley-Davidson's. You know, we were Harley guys to the core back in the day. And to a degree, I still consider myself more of a Harley person than a sport bike person.
Wow, I'm shocked. I didn't know that, Lee. But no, that's cool.
Yeah. If I had $20,000, the first thing I would do is not buy a KTM or a Ducati or any of the available production bikes. I mean, anything you can buy these days is an amazing piece of hardware, but I would take $20,000 and build myself one or two bikes just to have my own bike. I don't know. I don't think you can be an artist and not make your own art. Or if you work on bikes and you have the capability of building your own bike, I think you should. It's just difficult in California to be able to do that kind of stuff these days.
Oh, yeah, sure. With the emissions and all that, yeah. But well, all right. What kind of expectations have we got for the testing? I know, you know, testing is just testing, and you're probably going to be seeing a lot of things, and, you know, some of it's meaningless, some of it's not, et cetera, et cetera. But what can you tell us?
Well, I guess the first thing we're going to see is how much of a vacation the Japanese took, because it's been 6 weeks or more than 6 weeks since the last public test. Towards the end of November, and Japan got geared up. I don't know exactly how big Christmas was or New Year's was for them, but we know Yamaha needs to make more power on the top end. Honda definitely wants to perfect their package from HRC these days, and then also they've got to provide all the material for the satellite team, so that Honda's been hard at work. We're going to see what kind of straightaway times and speeds that those guys have in Sepang. So first thing to check is where the Japanese are at. Second thing to check is where Casey's at, because he's currently the measuring stick. And it's particularly interesting. I'll just say it's interesting because he rides a Ducati, and he's got a unique style, and you know, we'll see where our riders stack up to him, because we're running the same bike and the same tires. So I think that's going to be a good yardstick to say, oh, okay, it's not just the bike. And now that Rossi is riding on Bridgestones, we're not going to be able to say, oh, it's the tires. That's why he's completely beating Rossi head-to-head. I think Rossi's still the man to beat. I don't think there's ever been another racer quite like him. If I was a betting man, and I'm not, my money would be on him. As long as his bike is good enough, he's in the hunt, because even when his bike is not good enough, he's in the hunt.
So do you think, though, now if you're Joe Schlub back here in the States, where you get for you the testing, you know, you read a couple of articles and you see the times, and you know, a lot of it just comes from reading the times, so one lap. Do you think that Stoner is the kind of guy that's going to be out there pushing to get the fastest lap, or are we going to see something where it's like, oh, he's sandbagging, you know, what kind of analysis can we read into that, to those single lap times, you know, one lap on a set of qualifiers?
Well, I think for me, based on watching Casey in the paddock and in the garage, and just from the brief talks I've had with him, you know, which is really nothing other than enough to give me just a light feeling of the guy, my feeling is that he doesn't play any kind of mind games, like I'm going to sandbag and then I'm going to stomp everybody. Somebody who studies lap times quite closely would have noticed in 2007 that he goes out on his out lap and oftentimes will set his fast lap on the second lap. He'll just go out there and take the first few corners, and as soon as he crosses the finish line on the second lap, he drops the hammer. He doesn't fool around. He doesn't build his way up to it. It's quite different than the style of, say, Pedrosa, who takes a few laps to get into it. he gradually builds up, and then once he achieves a good pace, then he starts hammering out, you know, lap time after lap time. Whereas Casey just seems to go out and just boom, right off the bat, he throws it down. The lap times, that is. He throws down the lap times. I think Casey's just going to do his best. He doesn't really have any switch in between on and off. He's either on or he's off. And 2007, he was completely on. And we'll see what he does in 2008. Now, he is recovering from the shoulder injury he got in the last practice in Jerez. So from what I understand, it was a minor injury, and he should be fully recuperated and having a great time when he gets back. We'll see next week.
Yeah.
I think he's going to be fine.
Yeah, I agree.
Valentino got banged up, so we're going to see how well he's recovered. It's interesting. I spoke with one of Bridgestone's top people when I was at the factory. Just chance we happened to be having a coffee outside at the same time. I didn't know, you know, this guy was going to be there. And he came over and said, oh, you know, I recognize you from this team. And what do you think of your riders and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, I asked him, what did he think of Rossi? Because he'd just ridden the previous couple of days. He said that he's definitely the smartest guy out there. Just kind of confirming what everybody else thinks. That Rossi's definitely going to be a threat. But to hear it from this guy, it was quite serious.
Yeah, kind of adds some weight to it and stuff. And then,
analysis of things is amazing, apparently. How quickly he's able to identify the strengths and weaknesses of a compound or the family and whether he likes a tire or not.
And then, well, you got also on there on Dantin, you've got, like you said, two new riders. We've got, you know, Tony Elias and Sylvain Guintoli.
Sylvain Guintoli.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, both are extremely talented. It's going to be interesting to see how Elias's style, how it suits it. You know, how is he going to, you know, I'm looking forward to that, actually, and looking forward to once the season starts.
I think if everything's right, I mean, if the tires are working well and the bike is working good, then Tony can definitely be a threat. He's a little bit less consistent, I guess, than Sylvain. But Sylvain has just spent a year developing tires for Dunlop and doing an outstanding job on what was probably the last or second to last Yamaha on the grid, and then also on arguably the worst tires on the grid. So he did an amazing job last year. And I hope that he brings that same fire to develop the tires with Bridgestone, because obviously everyone gets, you know, the basic tire, and then they work with you to get you something that works best with each individual rider. So Tony's definitely going to take some work because he has a very unique riding style. And Sylvain is a little bit larger than him, has a different style once again. He reminds me of Rossi in his physical body positioning. You know, every photo or video that I've studied of Sylvain, the body position is the same, except for the helmet. You know, Rossi looks at the ground and Sylvain looks through the corner. So it'll be neat, almost a way of seeing what Rossi would look like on the bike, just because their physical body size and style is so similar.
Interesting.
You could almost lay the photos on top of one of each other. You know, if you took Sylvain on the Yamaha in a certain corner and then Rossi in that same corner, you could lay the photos on top of one another and only the helmets would be different. It's a little creepy.
But well, that's cool. So,
well, I'll be gone for 2 weeks, and then we do 1 week at Sepang, and then we're doing a second week at Phillip Island. We go directly from Malaysia to Phillip Island. We'll have a Sunday to kind of relax. I'm sure the Marlboro guys are going to go golfing or fishing, or they usually plan something fun when they have a free day in Australia. And then after Australia, we come back, we get ready for a test at Jerez over Valentine's weekend. And that's our first European run of 2008. So there's a lot of work to be done because we've got new semi-trailers this year with a slightly different interior. And we've got to get those ready. And I've got to get used to those because my previous race trailer had storage units and compartments built into the roof area. And this year's trailer doesn't have that. We're running a different system, so I've got to get used to the the physical parameters of my job for the European rounds. And then after Jerez, we've got a one-week break, and then we go to Qatar. And it's a little unusual because we're actually testing so close to the race time. Normally, the FIM has said you can't test at a certain racetrack 2 weeks before the race, and so on and so forth. But because this is the first time we're doing a night race, we're going to be there a week before the race testing, the IRTA test. We should be testing and practicing at night in the dark, and it's going to be, it should be the practice run for the race weekend a week later. So that means we get there in the late afternoon, get everything ready. The first practice is going to be at 6 or 7 or 8 o'clock, somewhere after the sun has set. I've seen the tentative schedule thanks to Jim Race, but, you know, those things are always a little flexible until you get there.
Sure.
And it's going to be definitely something interesting because I don't think anybody in the paddock is used to working overnight and sleeping through the day. And then also, I don't think the riders are going to be used to it either. I think it's going to be quite a shock to everyone's system to have to do that. And then it's also going to be interesting to see if the older riders suffer from night vision the way I personally do. I don't like particularly riding at night because everything's a little bit different. My eyesight's gotten worse over the years. And it'll be neat to see if these guys who are capable of racing right on the limit as fast as the young guys in the daytime are going to have any noticeable deficits due to their age when the night races come.
Yeah, that's a real good point. What kind of preparations have you guys as the team, have you done anything yet for the night race? I mean, I don't know, there's all sorts of things I can imagine that might have to, or is that something that we're sort of waiting until, you know, closer to the race?
I can't think of anything we have to do differently, to be honest with you. I mean, the garage is lit. We've got our own lighting, plus the lighting in the garage. Mm-hmm. And that's about it, I guess.
Yeah, and then pit lane
will just be lit. Christmas.
Yeah, that's good. You probably need a couple of them.
Yeah, I got a beautiful LED flashlight, the white spectrum of light. It's awesome. That was one of my cool Christmas presents.
Cool.
Oh, here's something fun I did. I went down to Los Angeles to see my father, and my brother happened to be in town, so that's why I went down there. But my girlfriend and I drove down just to spend time in the car and listen to music and got down to L.A. And while we were there, I managed to get a backstage tour to the Oakley factory, which
is
an amazing complex in Foothill Ranch, California. You drive up, and you don't really know that it's there. It's up on a small hillside, and there's a slightly overgrown motocross track out in front built into their hillside. You have to look twice in order to see that it's a motocross track, but they put a track there just so their sponsored riders could come and test their products, which is quite interesting. It shows some commitment.
Yes, indeed it does.
It's a beautiful facility. I mean, the main thing I remember is that it's vertically integrated so that their design team is there. They have the tooling and the machines necessary to create all their pieces of their eyeglasses and develop it right there and do the coatings on their lenses, and the shipping warehouse is right there. It's all in the same building. So basically someone could say, we want to do this, and we want to do this right now. And then it goes to the next room and the design guys say, okay, this is how we're going to do it. Then the guys in the workshop create the dye or whatever they need to make it. And then they go ahead and make it. And then all of a sudden it's in the box ready to go. But then, naturally, they don't have their electronics there, and their apparel, I think, comes out of Asia. So,
right, but their core.
Quite an amazing facility, and I came away highly impressed. It was just a really good experience to kind of walk around there. I took my younger brother with me, and it was cool just to see so many of the neat things and the vision of their boss. So it was nice because, you know, they obviously sponsor a lot of MotoGP athletes, and I'm always happy to support anybody that supports the sport that I love.
Oh, yeah, especially when they have a quality product, too. I mean,
yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. I do have an Oakley watch that I got for Christmas that I absolutely love.
Sounds like you made out pretty well at Christmas, damn. So
yeah, I had a fantastic Christmas, man.
Yeah.
I got a flashlight. I got a watch. I got a new hat. I got a jacket. It's my restocking. You know, in the same way that we restock at the beginning of the season to go through the season with the race parts from Ducati, because of the euro is so strong, and also because everything in Europe tends to be so expensive, I only go shopping twice a year, and that's Christmas time and then the week after Laguna Seca. Just things are cheaper in the U.S., and there's so much more variety, and it's the most consumer-friendly nation there is.
Yeah.
I stopped at Christmas.
Now, there's a question for you. Since you are paid in euros and everything, have you noticed that because of the falling dollar and everything, that's sort of like you're having now more money to do on your American shopping trips and visits home and everything, or is it sort of not happening enough to make much difference?
It doesn't really happen enough to make a huge difference to me. You know, I realize that I'm not making a ton of money out here at this point in my career, and it's not really my main goal to be making money right now. I'm just trying to have the best time I can and learn as much as I can. You know, so that being said, I never really had a ton of money to begin with. But when I do go back, I don't spare any expense if I can help it. You know, I think, you know, I live pretty cheaply in Europe. So if I want to go to dinner with my friends, boom, we're going to go to dinner. And I never think about, I don't want to spend any money on dinner. And for me, the time is so precious when I'm with my friends and my family that it's not even worth it to consider how much money we're going to be spending on food or presents or anything of that nature. It's like, wow, I've got 3 weeks to enjoy this. Amazingly enough, I got 3 weeks instead of two. Should have been 2 weeks probably. So I went big for 3 weeks. I gained just over 10 pounds of solid stomach muscle. And, you know, I wouldn't have traded any of the days. Every day had a great experience in it. And my mom knew that this was kind of a big moment. I hadn't seen her in a while. So she came into San Francisco for a week, and I was able to go hang out in Chinatown with her. And I had to see a doctor for something because I got sick towards the end of the season, and I wasn't sure why, because I've had colds before, but I wasn't sick like that before. So I got checked out by some doctors. I got an eye exam also because it was time to get my eyes checked up and just take care of a lot of things that it's easy to do when you're in the U.S. You can just say, oh, okay, I'm going to make a phone call, and then Friday I'm going to go to the doctor. But it's different when you live in a foreign country and you don't really know who you should go to or what you should do. And there's always time constraints that are a problem.
Sure.
I went back in for a full rebuild in the last 3 weeks, and that's exactly what I did. I slept late a lot of the time. I stayed up late. I did whatever felt best to me. And now I feel like I'm really recharged and ready to go. You know, there's some anticipation, and then there's a little bit of worry, a little bit of fear, like, it's a new year, material. I'm not really going to know the full situation of my job. I get to Sepang and spend a couple days there because I won't know what's landing in the boxes, per se. I mean, theoretically, I do know, but you never know until everything's in your hands and you can see it physically and go, okay, this needs to do this. This needs to go here. I need one of these. This has to change. And I've got to get there and put out a bunch of fires, so to speak.
Sure.
That way my team can keep running and they don't have to worry about it.
Yeah.
It's definitely a problem-solving position.
Yeah. Well, and you definitely sound better. I mean, the last time we talked, and I know you were trying to shake off whatever crud it was that you had, and you just sort of, you know, sounded a little down in the dumps and just not quite yourself. So you do sound like you've got a good recharge going, and that's a really good thing.
Yeah, I needed that. And I was a little down in the dumps towards the end of last season. It's always depressing knowing that your rider is going to retire.
Yeah,
I've looked up to Alex Barrows for a lot of years. He's the first GP personality that I spoke with in person when I went to my first race in China. I caught him at an autograph signing, and then again, you know, after China in 2005, I saw him again at Laguna Seca. We spent an hour together with my friends and him. And, you know, we've always had, like, a good relationship where we could just kind of joke about whatever. And, you know, I've gone to dinners with him. And such a really nice guy to be around. You know, doesn't have the giant ego associated with, you know, an international star. Just it was kind of a bummer to see him go. And then also, I think a lot of people don't really realize the impact. But when we lost Alex Hoffman after Estoril, that's a big shock to him because all of a sudden he's out of a job and he's disgraced in the media and so on and so forth. But it's a shock to the team, too, because you have a crew that's kind of dedicated that year to doing their best to give him, you know, a capable bike. And, you know, when it goes south for whatever reason, you know, it could be a totally justifiable reason. Like he said, I quit. I don't want to ride this bike anymore. Or he said, I don't have motivation. Or, you know, there were other factors involved. It just kind of tends to be a blow to everybody. And I think we all needed some time. Every member of the team needed some time to kind of adjust to that and say, okay, why am I here? What am I here to do? Do I want to continue doing this? And just kind of get back in the game. Because it's not an easy process, I would say, to take a new rider every week and say, okay, this is our rider this week, and we've got to get him up to speed, and we're going to be doing our best and working at the level that we know we're capable of, but is the rider going to be able to utilize that, and so on and so forth. So it was, you know, we take on different riders, and you see what they can do, and that was difficult because half the garage was always kind of up in the air, and that was the side of the garage that I'm more familiar with because I worked with those guys as a mechanic in 2006. So that was, you know, kind of a bummer also towards the end of last season. And then there was the travel schedule, which instead of having the 3 weeks worth of flyaways through Asia, we had 2 weeks and then come back to Europe and then fly back out to Asia. And then immediately after the Asian round, we had to get back to Valencia, which was the final race. So there really wasn't any time to catch your breath and you know, get pumped up about it. You know, I like to be really excited for each race, and every time I hear the bikes fire up, it gives me a little charge. But after so many weeks of being kind of on the run and feeling like you're behind the eight ball because, you know, who's your rider? And, okay, now we got Chaz. Okay, Chaz is hurt. What can we do to make the situation better? Are we just out here spinning laps? You know, Barros is unhappy. It seemed like there were a lot of factors kind of coming into play that made it difficult to keep the motivation high. And, you know, everybody wants to do our best. That's what we're here to do. And, you know, I can't even begin to think about what it was like for Kenny Roberts' team.
Yeah, yeah.
but definitely, you know, there are times when I can't remember who said it, but there's a quote from somebody that it's easy to stay in racing when you're winning. You know, it's easy to keep coming back year after year when you're the top team and you've got the top rider and so on and so forth. It was probably in one of the Faster movies or something. Yeah. I remember along those lines. But when you're kind of mid-pack or towards the back of the pack, it's really difficult to keep coming back. So I hear some things, you know, on one side, people in the U.S., California, my friends are like, man, you're there, and you know, at least you're there. And I go, yeah, it's huge just to be here. But, you know, we've got this hunger to do well. You know, we got a podium at Mugello, and you know, that's the kind of result that we want to keep shooting for. Even though it was difficult at the end of last year, I think through the off season and putting in all this time and hard work towards getting 2008 ready, that kind of, as we were rebuilding things for 2008, it kind of builds yourself stronger and your resolve. And you know, I kind of grew up a little bit in certain ways just because of that. Plus, I'm older now.
Yes, yes, indeed. You're well into your 30s.
Yeah, I'm officially in my 30s. I can't pass for a late 20s guy anymore.
No, definitely not. Pretty soon people will think you're 40.
But. Yeah. Ooh. No, that's never actually been a problem.
No.
Age is just a number, because I've always said since I was a teenager that it's not the years, it's the miles.
Yes, and you're only as old as you feel is always the best way to put that one, yeah. But
Yeah. So let's see, what else is going on for 2008? I mean, the last little thing is about 2008. The season's here already. My God. Kind of kooky. We don't have an IRTA test in Barcelona. We've got night races. Okay, we covered that. We've got new riders coming in. Lorenzo, Dovizioso, and De Angelis. Those 250 kids are going to be playing.
Indeed, yes. And that's going to be an interesting show to watch.
To open up the Lorenzo Valentino thing.
Oh, yeah.
Save that for another call.
Yeah, yeah. And we'll have to do another call soon. We won't let it go as long. Maybe we can shoot for when you get back from PI, if you're not super busy that week. And
Sure.
Yeah, that would be good stuff.
I just want to say thanks to everybody for continuing to stick with MotoGPOD. If you'd like to see some of the fun things I did over the off season, you can go to my website, motoliam.com. I had a fun time building a little engine with my buddy Jay and other friends. Brad were involved, and you know, just things that I used to be able to do at any time back when I lived in California. You know, I don't get a chance to do those things anymore. So the fact that we all got together and had a man weekend was pretty cool. Even though I guess technically every time I'm at the races, it's a man weekend.
Yeah, but it's
no
different
wives
when it's not
girlfriends allowed. Yeah, it's different when it's work.
yeah, that too. But well, thanks to you for always being on the show. We love having you. It's always interesting to talk to you, Liam. And definitely take a look at the MotoLiam.com website if you haven't seen it. He's got a great website. But So right on. Thank you very much for being on the show. I do appreciate again the call, and we're going to talk to you again real soon, Liam. Okay?
Great. Thanks. Talk to you later, Bob. See you, everybody.
All right. That's going to do it for today's show. Hope you enjoyed it. It was nice talking to Liam again. It's been too long since I talked to him. Like I said, with all the holidays and everything else, it was just difficult to get a hold of him. He was doing his own thing. I was doing my thing one way or the other. But we'll keep in touch with him and wish him the best of luck down there in Sepang and PI, and we'll talk to him after that, see what's going on with those testing. And then another item that I failed to mention in my intro, so much for quality note-taking, and this was a heads-up from Warren Kurtz at Kurtz Customs Motorsports Incorporated, and Warren has suggested Pit Pass Radio podcast before, but he sent me a particular heads-up. He says there's going to be some very good MotoGP insight on Pit Pass Radio podcast. He says, I think Schwantz is a scheduled guest, so we might be hearing Kevin Schwantz on Pit Pass Radio. They do put on a good show, so I encourage you to look for that one there on iTunes. Pit Pass, two words, pitpassradio.com. Or no, excuse me, not .com. Pit Pass Radio on iTunes. You can find it there. Go ahead and take a listen. It's a very well put together show. Long ones, too. So some good stuff. They have some good interviews. And they might have Schwantz coming up. And, of course, there's always another podcast that I enjoy listening to a lot. And that's Formula One Blog. That's Formula spelled out. One, the number one, blog. .com, and they have a podcast there. They talk largely, of course, about Formula One, but they do touch on MotoGP. It's a very entertaining podcast. If you're at all a Formula One fan, I do encourage you to check that one out too. Longtime friends of MotoGPOD. All right. And then, one other thing, talking about the Liam call. Thanks to God again. I'm posting the link to that Mark Elder story that he mentioned that's on Superbike Planet. And it's a good story. It's sort of parallels a little bit Liam's story, you know, American working in MotoGP and all of that. And it's quite a long write up there on the soup. So take a look at that. The link will be up there on MotoGPOD. Or if you just go to Superbike Planet, do a search for Mark Elder, you'll find it, that sort of thing, one way or the other. Encourage you to read it. It's good stuff. And also, a lot of good articles have been coming up in magazines the past couple issues. Road Racer X, the latest issue, Road Racing World, and Cycle News all had their various takes on 800 GP bikes and all sorts of good stuff. Cycle News had a interview with Alex Barros, a sort of a going away interview. So if you don't get those magazines, take a trip down to Borders or Barnes & Noble or whatever your favorite larger bookstore where they have a good selection of magazines, and see if you can pick up those copies. And I also encourage you to subscribe, particularly Road Racer X. Excellent magazine, very, very well put together, beautifully produced. Always enjoyed it. And Chris Johnham's a great guy. All those guys are great guys. Dean Adams at the Superbike Planet. Everybody else. They're all great guys. Hey, again, so much for taking notes, right? I can't remember these guys' names. And one last thing, touching on our upcoming schedule. We are going to have a show next week. I've got a good one planned already. There's going to be quite a few interesting things that we're going to talk about. And then I'm going to take another week off because I've got a Navy thing going on. So we will have a show on the 25th of January. However, the 1st of February, we're going to skip. But then we're going to be getting into the season, and hopefully I'll be able to get my stuff all in order so that I'll be able to focus a little more attention on getting ready for the show and finding some guests and stuff. I've got a few leads going on. I think there's going to be some interesting stuff. Plus, every time we have a MotoGP season coming up, we know that it's the best season ever. So we're going to have a lot to talk about on all of that. And between now and then, like I said, again, one more shout out to my son going in the Marines. And I think I am super, super proud of him on that one. I think it's going to be a really, really cool thing. I say jokes and stuff about how he's going to get a serious lesson in focus, which is a good thing, and maybe a nice hot cup of shut the hell up, which is also probably a helpful thing. But in any case, I think that he'll... It'll do him a lot of good, and I'm real proud of him on that. So on that somewhat sappy, proud of my son note, why don't we call it a day, and I will talk to you guys all next week. Seeing as this show doesn't seem to be about MotoGP very often anymore, I'm not even sure that I really need to mention all of this stuff, but I sort of feel semi-obligated because I'm always doing it and it's part of the name. So I'm going to just let you know real quick that MotoGPOD is produced by Bob Hayes, that's me, and I'm solely responsible for its content. So even when I sound like a complete idiot, it's just me. All of the guests and everything on the show are pretty smart, erudite individuals. I'm the one who makes the rest of the show sound sort of like a Laurel and Hardy routine. And I just want to let you know that MotoGP is a trademark of Dorna Sports SL, and the MotoGPOD podcast and MotoGPOD.com are not affiliated with Dorna Sports SL in any way, shape, or form. All other trademarks are the property of their respective owners, and MotoGPOD is not affiliated with any of them.